Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Reg Hoare. He's the Managing Director of MHP Financial. Reg has over 30 years of Citi experience, switching to financial PR in 1995 after a successful early career in investment banking and securities at S&G Warburg and Nomura. Hello, Reg, and welcome to LSE Share Talks Conquest Corner. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Peter, and great to be interviewed today, and very grateful for the chance to share my experience and views with your listeners.
Thank you ever so much. Now, I will stress to our listeners that this is Reg's personal views on certain matters we're going to discuss, and not the opinion of the company that he currently works for. Now, Reg, whereabouts in the world are you today?
I'm sitting in the city of London, well, in London itself, not in the city, because actually MHP, a few years ago, we moved up into the West End. So we're just off the Strand, in fact, sort of Trafalgar Square end.
Right, so that's the office at Haygarth Street, is it?
Absolutely.
Okie dokie. Go on.
I was going to say that actually quite a few private investors who maybe are listening to this will have come to our offices to some of the equity development forums that we host here.
Okie dokie. We can cover some of that a little bit later on. The equity development side of things and seeing people face to face is something that's been reiterated quite a number of times, especially with the likes of Leon Boros and Mark Bentley of ShareSell, the importance of meeting companies face to face.
Yeah, hear, hear. Absolutely, yeah. Vital.
Yeah. Okay. For those that are not aware of you, Reg, or have missed you with regards to all the different things you've done thus far, I just want you to introduce yourself and give our listeners and people that listen to this podcast a background, where you started, how you started, how you did, what you studied, you know, your journey, what has led us to having the conversation today, please.
Well, I started, I guess, I mean, sort of switching back to the early years. I was brought up as a farmer's son in Gloucestershire, and the city was a kind of alien place, but sadly my father, the business didn't go very well, and so when I got into my teenage years, there was no longer an option to become a farmer. So when I got to university, it was a question of, well, what am I going to do in the great wide world? And I was doing a degree in politics, which included quite a big segment of economics, and the city seemed like a kind of, you know, a logical or potentially interesting place to go. And so I applied for a few graduate trainee opportunities, and had the opportunity to be interviewed by one particular one that then went on to offer me a job. And that was back in 1983, which if anybody does the maths, will tell you I'm now in my mid-50s.
Yes.
So I did that graduate traineeship at a firm called Lawrie Milbank, which was an old stockbroking partnership firm. And that was great experience, because the first year you basically went around all the different departments. So the first week they really brought you crashing down to earth from your, you know, gilded university lifestyle. And they sent you out as a messenger to learn about, you know, the streets of the City of London, where all the big institutions were based. And also, so you met the other messengers who obviously had very different backgrounds.
So that was you doing almost like the taxi guy's knowledge bit.
Yeah, literally the literally the knowledge. Yeah. It was a really, sadly, I suspect that doesn't happen these days,
and
but it was
maybe it should do,
absolutely, to add a bit of humility to things. But I'll always remember being amazed that they would trust one to take checks around the city. And one of Lawrie Milbank's businesses or areas of business was money broking. And so they would send these huge checks between institutions, and they would rely on the messengers to take the check from institution A to institution B. And you could see, you know, it wasn't like it was in an envelope or anything. You know, you could see that this thing was for millions of pounds. And of course, that was how things had to be done in those days, because there was no internet or anything. There was no internet banking. Yeah. And then I spent some time in the general office, which was basically the back office where, you know, accounts were done, where dividends were received and paid out to customers, the portfolio valuations, you know, all of those sorts of things. I then went into the private client department, and probably that was where I first really began to get really interested in the equity markets. And in those days, wealth management, as we call it now, was very unsophisticated. And basically the individual guys in the department would really just pick and choose a few shares. Most of it was done on the phone with the clients, so there was no, you know, discretionary fund management didn't exist. You know, letters would come in from bank branches around the country, from bank managers saying, oh, we've, you know, a lady's come into the bank this afternoon and she wants to know what to do with her share portfolio. We used to then, you know, respond to those letters, giving advice and hoping that we then might get the business on the back of it. And on that interest in the equity markets meant that when I finally sort of finished my tour of the firm, I had a choice to go into one of the departments. And I basically put my hand up and said, I want to go into the institutional broking bit rather than the private client bit, because I thought that that was overall more exciting. It was obviously, you know, big institutions, big sums of money. So I became a salesman rather than an analyst. And I did that for the next 11 years, so from sort of 84 through to 95.
So explain the difference between the salesman bit and the analyst bit.
Yeah, so, you know, the analysts are the guys that go along to the analyst meetings on the morning of results. Yeah. They're the ones that publish the research notes. You know, and they're the ones that have most interaction with the companies themselves. Exactly. And the sales guys, generally speaking, are sitting back in the office and they're ringing up the institutional investors. So ringing up the fund managers at Schroders and BlackRock and M&G and all those big outfits. And basically what they're doing is they're selling the research product. So they're saying, right, this morning there have been results from, you know, BP and Marks & Sparks. And, you know, this is what our analysts are saying. And obviously the salesman has an opportunity to put a little bit of his own experience and his own colour on that. And hopefully the fund manager then listens to what he's got to say. And ultimately, hopefully, you know, that fund management house will give some trades to that investment bank. And that's how the kind of business model works. Obviously, that's put very simplistically, and things have changed massively since then. Become more...
So what year was that when you became a salesman?
So that was 84, back end of 84.
One-year graduate essentially.
Exactly.
You were shown through all the different hoops, and 84 you plumbed for that one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Excellent. Yeah. And in those days, we weren't paid much money. So I think I started on 5,750 quid.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And the equivalent of someone starting now at that sort of salary is nearer to 45.
I think that's right. So it is staggering, the inflation.
Yeah. And they're still, what, 22, 24 years of age?
Yeah, that's right. The prize, in those days, of course, the prize was that all these firms were partnerships. And, you know, the reason you joined them was the hope that you might one day become a partner. And then obviously if you became a partner, then you had the potential to share in the profits of the firm. You know, that was, you know, an attractive opportunity. But of course, Big Bang, changed all of that. Yeah. It was very much the US model. We moved from what was known as single capacity, so you could only be a stockbroker or a merchant bank or a stock jobber, as they were known, the firms that made markets. You could only have single capacity. You couldn't have all of those disciplines under one roof. Big Bang changed that, and suddenly you had the creation of investment banks in the US model that really did all of those different disciplines.
Very much so, and that's when everyone splitting up and segueing away lots of their assets, weren't they?
Yeah.
The mergers all happened in 2009.
That's right. Yeah.
Okie dokie. Thanks ever so much for covering your background there for me. I just wanted to go back to one bit there where you said you did your university bit. Which university did you say you went to?
I was at Bristol.
Bristol.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Right. Okay. So given that you studied politics, you did economics, were you always attracted to the investment side of things? You touched on it a little bit there, Reg.
Yeah, I think the
you said you couldn't do the farming bit, and there was no more available to you.
That's right. But actually, funnily enough, my dad did have a few shares, and actually, when I was a teenager, he did buy me a couple of things, and I think from memory they were Allied Lions, as it then was, which subsequently became Allied Breweries and then got taken over, and Cadbury Schweppes, I think. And I remember at school sort of charting the share prices.
Oh,
And then inevitably, you know, you get distracted by other things. Yeah. And it wasn't until a bit later, until, you know, that, you know, particularly doing the economics bit of politics, that a little bit of interest sort of, you know, came about again. And obviously that was a dramatic period, sort of, you know, when I was at uni, 79 through to, 80 to 83, when I was at uni, was a dramatic period, you know, with very serious recession, the early years of Thatcherism, et cetera. And the whole sort of monetarism experiment. So it was a really fascinating time.
That was around the same time as well, when we were pushing towards the privatization of almost everything, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And indeed, those first kind of couple of years as a broker, I spent a lot of time on privatizations. Because there was a great opportunity for all the broking firms, you know, to really make some money. On that, that was really interesting learning about that.
Okay, so given that your dad bought you your first shares when you were in teens and gave you an introduction to stocks, do you remember the first stock that you individually purchased?
Yeah, I think it was an investment trust.
Right.
Which I think I did. I was given the shares by a godparent or something like that. And so when I started in stockbroking, I kind of looked it up and I thought, oh, this looks quite interesting, and I might actually buy some more, because it was a tiny weeny holding. And I think it was called the Stockholders Investment Trust. I don't think it doesn't exist anymore. But I think that was my first trade. So that wasn't very exciting, I've got to say. And then my first experience of a real sort of punting stock was around that time. There was inevitably, as there is now, people were always interested in natural resources. And there was a funny little natural resources thing called Asia Oil and Minerals, which was a real sort of punting stock. And I bought a few of those, not very successfully, and sort of learnt my first lesson about, you know, how to lose a few hundred quid quite quickly.
I think
it was pure noise, and it was during the period of my training, of my graduate training, when I spent 3 months down on the floor of the old stock exchange, as a blue button, as they were known. A blue button, and you weren't allowed to deal, you weren't allowed to trade, but you were allowed to ask prices of shares. And so you were sent. You were really a runner or a gopher. So that was kind of, I think, where I heard the noise, and it didn't do me much good. So that was a kind of early. That was an early lesson in this stock market game can be, you know, quite racy. But equally, it sort of whetted my appetite, I guess.
Excellent. There was a lot to be said for noise, unfortunately, no matter what circles you're in.
Yeah.
Given that. Going back to the 80s and 90s, where you first whetted your appetite, and you've done what you've done so successfully now, having worked at SG Warburg and Nomura, and you've learned so much and gained so much insight. How would you describe yourself now, Reg, regarding your investment style and strategy?
Well, I think it's sort of developed over the years, and it's now very much a part of my kind of, you know, planning for later on in life, in particular sort of moving towards retirement, hopefully in the next 10 years or something. So most of my investments are currently in a SIP, I'm running it in a way that is trying to maximize basically you know, the value of that SIP over the next few years, and that's really my focus in terms of how I'm running my money. So it's long term. It's about capital appreciation. I'm also rebuilding slowly but surely my ISA, which I had to raid because I did a rather extravagant thing and bought a place in Spain.
When did you do that?
I did that. Well, actually, I bought the land back in 2001, and I started building just after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and finished in 2010.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, unlike Leon, I can't claim to have a £1 million ISA.
Right.
But that's
raided, but
exactly.
Well, have been a lot nearer to it. I did not raid it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But anyway, the intention obviously is to build that back up. And actually, in recent years, I've always actually going back 20, 25 years, I've always been interested in investing in private businesses, largely because a really good mate of mine started a business and there was an opportunity to put some money in. So over the years, I've been interested in that. And obviously, recently, with the more sophisticated tax opportunities there are through the EIS scheme, I'm also using that route to provide me with some alternative assets to the sort of, you know, standard stock market ones.
Okay, so EIS, VCs, and also angel funds sort of things.
Actually, I haven't done funds. They've all been. I did a couple of VCTs. Yes, and I've still got one of them, which I've actually moved into my SIP. But the other ones have all been individual companies, which have got EIS status.
And you've vetted them and
checked them all out? Yeah, I've done, you know, I've met the team, I've done my due diligence as far as one can. And they've been in businesses that I think I've sort of broadly felt comfortable that I know enough about those industries that they were worth investing in those businesses.
Covered this regarding your work. It states that your preference or the sector that you cover the most is financial services, TMT, and built environment. But in your personal portfolio, what sectors do you have a preference for and why?
I think that if I'm looking at my SIP at the moment, I've probably got something like 40 or 50% of it in investment trusts. So actually I suppose in a way that's financial services, but obviously the investment trusts are investing in right across all the sectors. So investment trusts are really core part of my kind of portfolio management. Then yes, I have tended to focus on the sectors that I feel most comfortable in and which I feel I understand and I've got some knowledge of, et cetera, et cetera. And that does mean, yes, there are some financial services. I've got a bit of house building. I've got some, just looking down here, what else? Quite a lot of technology, particularly software on the technology side. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. So that's kind of broadly. And historically, I had avoided certain sectors that I kind of didn't know anything about or didn't know enough about. So I've tended to avoid natural resources. And of course, when I have gone into them, inevitably, I wish I'd continued to avoid them. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, once bitten, it seems it's been following me around. So I mean, at the moment, for example, I haven't got any retailers. I've just bought some Lloyds Bank, actually. So I've gone back into the banking sector the first time for a while. But broadly, my sector coverage is actually relatively narrow.
Okie dokie. Now, somebody's asked me this question this morning, so I'm just going to introduce this new question. On a personal level, because obviously you do this for a living, you work for a very large company. On a personal level, when you're researching your own stocks to buy, how much time do you spend researching them, watching them, before you make a purchase, Reg?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think it depends whether it's a stock I know already, you know, or one that's completely new to me. And the other caveat I'd give is that I tend to be a bit time poor because of the full-time job. I don't always have that luxury to spend a long time or, you know, wait until there's an opportunity to meet the management or whatever. And quite often, I will admit that I will buy things either on instinct or because I trust the person that maybe has mentioned the stock to me as being a sort of wise and canny investor. And other times, I'll do some proper work on it. So there's a real variety of experiences in terms of the stocks I own. I mean, the things I've bought since Brexit have pretty much exclusively been either topping up existing holdings or I've bought things that I've known for some time and therefore have got a confidence that I know the business.
Go on.
You know, that's probably all I was going to say on that.
Okay, sorry. I was going to mention, I'm not going to mention the name of the stop, but one stop you tweeted about less than an hour ago.
Yes,
had a profit warning, not the name of the stop. However, you said that you actually like the guys running that company, and you've got the feeling that in this adversity, that's going to be the time when this company shows their strength and they're going to do all right long term.
Yep.
So this goes back to what you were saying, and Mark Bentley has said it, and Leon Boris has said it, and Annabelle Brody Smith has said it as well, is that you've got to know the company sometimes to know whether or not to get out or even to buy them in times of difficulty.
Yeah, without doubt. I think, you know, if you've met the guys, you've seen them present, you know, that is absolutely a critical element. You know, see the whites of their eyes, you know, kick the tires, all those cliches, you know. So if you have got a chance, go along to the AGM, go along to one of the equity development forums, go along to Mellow, go along to ShareSoc. You know, that is a brilliant opportunity to do all of that kind of due diligence, because the reality is you don't get a sense of a company's culture. You don't get a sense of the personalities of the individual management merely from reading an annual report. Equally, I think actually the videos that a lot of companies are doing are a very good way as well of getting a sense of that business and getting a sense of the management team and whether you, frankly, whether you like the look of them, whether you trust them, you know, whether you like the cut of their jib. And that's a bit of a kind of personal feeling that you get. In my experience, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's large cap, mid cap, small cap. You know, frankly, you get all sorts of management in at every layer. You know, ones you can trust and ones you can't trust. But equally, there are those who've got a dubious track record in certain areas, such as remuneration, who might actually fundamentally be very good managers. But they might be particularly good managers in M&A situations or in crisis management situations. You know, they may not necessarily be the best guys to run a company in a growth situation. So there is a bit also of that kind of horses for courses. Have you got the right man as CEO for that particular company, you know, at the right stage of its development? So that's kind of another kind of value judgment that one has to try and make amongst all the other judgments that enable one to buy a stock.
Absolutely agree. I think the difficulty out there is that, like, as you said, people are very, very time constrained regarding choosing stocks, and they don't have the time to do that research. And just looking at one element of a stock is never enough. There's so many different elements.
So many different elements. Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, you see that. You see that so much, Peter, with the, you know, with the brokers. You know, the analysts have got more time than any of us to be researching these companies, and yet they get it horrendously wrong. You know, so and some of my worst holdings, my worst performing holdings, have been ones that I've bought having seen a broker's note, because I get the luxury, you know, being in financial PR, I get the luxury of seeing broker's notes coming into my inbox, you know, across many stocks and sectors. And now and again, my eye is drawn to one because I like the, you know, I look at the valuation or the recommendation or, you know, whatever it is. And it's remarkable how often those, you know, even the professionals get it wrong.
It's human nature, we get influenced. It's a bit like shopping, either steer us down the aisle and we see some of the new products and the new branding of it.
Totally.
And we're drawn to it like you know.
Moths. Yeah, bees are moths to the flame.
Moths to a flame, that's probably the suitable analogy for finance.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have an essential criteria, Reg? You've met the team, you've done the research, they're in the sector that you like. What are the essential criteria that leads Reg to go, I'm buying some of those today?
Generally, I think probably the majority of my stocks are, you know, profitable businesses that pay a dividend, that got sound balance sheets, that generally are cash generative and are, you know, maybe have got good margins, reasonably good market shares, unique products, you know, barriers to entry, you know, all of those good things. I have to say I'm not disciplined enough, not having enough time to sort of have a checklist and tick the boxes on them. But there's no doubt that, you know, one of the reasons, for example, I like software companies in the technology space is because they tick all those boxes. You know, they tend to be high margin businesses. They're very cash generative. They generally have cash on the balance sheet. In most cases, their products are pretty targeted, pretty unique. They might only have one or two competitors. So, you know, and those market shares are very defensible, and the barriers to entry are large because it costs so much money to develop new software. So I try and sort of tick the boxes in all of those areas. I suppose I'm also, I also like the idea of value. Over the years, I've always liked the idea of, you know, single digit PEs, you know, where the yield maybe crosses over with the PE. So that's always attracted me. You know, those sort of income, undervalued income plays. And also like a little bit of recovery now and again. So now and again, I'll look at something that looks bombed out, unloved, underbroked, all of those things, and think to myself, actually, that's, you know, that's a fundamentally quite a decent company. You know, why is it looking so cheap?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all the things that you've said there. And the other thing I look for, and I tend to research the new directors or the new CEOs that are coming in.
Yeah, and if absolutely.
A really, you know, fundamentally sound company has got a new CEO or chief financial officer coming in, then I'll research them. And if he's absolutely a specialist in turnaround, I'm like, I'm on it.
That's one of the reasons, you know, that I hold two or three stocks is for that reason, that the guys have got a good track record somewhere else and they've now moved on to a new place, you know, which looks a decent company or a decent opportunity. And so I've bought the shares in the vehicle that the chief exec has moved to, hoping he repeats the trick.
Yeah. That's what happened with me last year when I bought Exchange and the insurance company.
Yep.
The new CEO came in, and within a couple of months, he was like, "Right, okay, I'm not going to be able to fix this, but I'm going to sort it out so we get a good price for it."
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
And just went, and then I think we had in the end four bids for it, four different companies wanting to buy it. It was amazing.
It was great in the end. Absolutely, couldn't agree more. Well, I mean, the two I suppose I bought that I can think of immediately that come to mind. I've just bought Tribal Group. Because the new chief exec there had a very good track record at something called Allocate Software, which made lots of money for shareholders and then was sold at a nice premium. So I think he's a good man to follow. And one of the reasons I bought Inland Homes is that the guys that founded that and run that used to run something called Country and Metropolitan, which they made lots of money out of and sold at a very good premium. So, you know, these are guys with proven track records, you know, and in sectors that they know and understand, and therefore can kind of transfer their IP across.
Very, very important to look at the CEOs and the CFOs that you've got.
That's right.
Reg, this is a question that everyone likes and dislikes, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What has been the greatest lesson you've attained since you started investing?
Ooh, yeah, well, I think this has been said by others. It's the psychology, the emotion, you know, all of those, you know, all of our sort of human weaknesses that unfortunately sometimes dictate our investment decisions. And I, as much as anybody, have been guilty over the years of, you know, not selling things when I should have done because I was kind of emotionally attached to it. Equally, I've probably been guilty on a number of occasions of trying to catch the falling knife. Because I thought the bear raid was you know, ill-informed, or the profits warning would, you know, be quickly reversed, or, you know, whatever it was. And I think a little bit more of the cold sort of rational thinking, you know, on those occasions, or maybe just waiting 24 hours or 48 hours, you know, that equally would have been helpful.
Yeah. Okay. I love that answer.
Yeah.
I've been reading, and I've been recommending to everybody, the book Hypno Trading by Catherine Stott.
It's
called Guide to Using Hypnosis and NLP to Improve Your Trading Performance. And she's been coaching and has coached guys in and around the city for the last five odd years. And she must have coached, I don't know, between 200 and 1,000 traders, and every single one of them are different. You know, different issues and traits. Have such faults that need to be
well, and the stock market, Peter, is like a sort of hive of all of that. And so if you can imagine, I mean, my father, RIP, God rest his soul, was bipolar. Right. And I've always felt the stock market was a bit like he was. You know, one minute it's up, it's euphoric, and the next minute it's down, and it's really down in the dumps. So I think one has to, all of that whole sort of emotion psychology thing is a really important thing to understand and learn about. And so invariably it means the market gets oversold and overbought, and the canny investor will sell it when it's overbought and he'll buy it when it's oversold.
Absolutely agree with that. And I think what's happened as well, Ray, to add to it, to what you've, a great point you've made, is that speed of execution and HFTs and the involvement of algorithms now are making it so that every single wording of any sort of RNS or change of interest rates or monetary sort of noise, the computers now are running the show. So it's, you've got bipolar, A&I sort of computers going on, taking
absolutely
over what man used to do by communication.
Scary. It is scary. Yeah. And we've particularly seen that in the last 2 weeks.
I was going to say, talking about scary, let's just touch on the EU ref and the results and how that's impacting investing in your viewpoint.
Well, I think it's made it even more difficult. You know, it's been really difficult the last few years to make money because we've been in a low growth, you know, environment. You know, we've had crises, financial crises, you know, problems elsewhere in the world which have affected the UK. So, you know, it's really, really difficult to make money at the moment. And I think that the events of the last couple of weeks are going to make it even more difficult, or as difficult as it's ever been. And I think that I fear that, you know, the economy is going to come off a bit, hopefully not into recession, but I certainly think we're going to see a further sort of notch downwards in terms of the sort of slower growth that we saw earlier this year. So I think it's going to be a tough few months for the UK, if not a tough few years. Having said that, you know, for the canny investor, that will throw up opportunities.
I was just going to say, I'm looking at this being a write-off for the second half of this decade, unfortunately. As a contrarian, I'm like, oh.
You know, yeah.
I'll still be nibbling and having a little
totally.
Go, but I'm not going to be as optimistic going forward for the next 3.5
years. Yeah, no, I quite absolutely, and I'm generally a, you know, glass half full man, so it's difficult, you know, to not want to be positive about things, but I think the reality is it's going to be tough.
It is, and on a personal level and a business level. Work for MHP now, Financial. They've got offices in Hong Kong, Brussels and Sydney. Is that going to have any impact, or will it have impact on your business or other businesses that have got multiple and dual locations, i.e. France and the UK, Germany and the UK, and so on and so forth?
I think inevitably it's going to lead to questions about how you resource those and where you invest. Yeah, as a business. Yeah, as a business, there's no doubt. It's a bit like having a portfolio, you know, in reality, because we as MHP have a number of, you know, different disciplines within our business. And, you know, it's, you know, do you back the winners or do you keep investing in the losers because you hope they might turn round? And actually, the history of MHP shows that we probably should have invested a bit more in our winning teams, you know, rather than trying to prop up our less successful parts of our business. So it's going to be interesting to see how managers, chief execs, you know, decide to invest where they're going to put their money over the next few years, depending on how they see things. But I think, you know, Europe's problems are probably, you know, potentially greater than ours, you know, in terms of the European economy. The euro having strengthened against the pound, you know, is arguably overvalued, particularly when you take Germany out of the equation. And clearly what's going on with the Italian banks is, you know, potentially is not great. So I think all of those factors will be taken into account as well. Our focus at MHP, our next sort of port of call is the US. That's the obvious missing link for us. We've got discussions ongoing with a partner in the US that we hope to have an arrangement with in future.
Excellent. Just going back a little bit of what you said there about troubled banks and all the rest of it. hits in the headlines, or has, well, I've been watching it since 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010. Deutsche Bank is now at an all-time low from its IPO. There's now questions rearing its head again and again and again about its level of exposure to derivatives. Now, if something does go seriously wrong with that, surely that's going to impact Europe, Germany, the DAX, and domino effects for all the other banks.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's you know, potentially a nasty sort of risk element. I think the banks overall are in better shape than they were in 2008. I think that's clear. But they're by no means in perfect shape. And I think the reality is that quite a few of them, particularly in southern Europe, have been hiding some of the issues that they have. And in fact, my experience, I'll just quickly mention my experience in Spain, for example, you know, means I'm quite interested in the Spanish banks. And basically, you know, a lot of them have still not written down the value of residential properties, which they have inherited as a result of people going bankrupt. You know, they're still holding those properties at crazy valuations.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the difficulty is that there's quite a lot of expats over there. Some of them started returning when the property prices dipped and then left the properties empty or decided to just sell them on a bargain basement back to the banks. And then the expectation was, you know what, people that have been buying, who were mainly a lot of them were English, weren't they, and Irish,
yeah,
they would continue to buy, and invariably they didn't, did they?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of construction plans just left on hold.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, there's been definitely, if you go down, all around Spain, I think the last stat I read that there had been something like 750,000 unsold apartments around Spain, which is just, you know, a staggering number. Anyway.
Okay. I think you've covered this a little bit. I'm going to ask this question so you can maybe get a slightly different answer or more of an answer. What has been your wisest investment decision to date, Reg?
Ooh, there you go. That's a good question. I think actually, probably like a lot of people, it's going to be having got into the London property market nice and early when I came up to work here and live here. So it's not a stock market story, but a general investment story.
And
yeah.
When did you purchase your first property?
Well, I was lucky enough, of course, in those days, even on the modest starting salary that I referred to earlier. You know, the good news is that property prices were very low in the sort of mid-80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So by 1986, I think from memory, I think I was earning about 18,000, and I was able to buy a flat for 67,000, two-bedroom flat in Wandsworth, which is now a kind of highly desirable location. Yeah. Certainly wasn't 30 years ago. That sort of multiple, if I look at the multiple of my current home, it's significantly higher, you know, that the multiple between salary and value is significantly higher than that. So, you know, my generation were lucky to be able to get into the property market at that point. However, of course, we had to pay a lot more in terms of the mortgages. Shocking. And I remember in 92, I think it was, immediately after the exit from the ERM, or around that time, I think I paid my highest ever mortgage rate, which was a staggering 15.2%, which was a little scary. Anyway, the key to it has been to be in the market and to, as far as you can, get the timing right so that you're always moving, you know, moving from maybe, you know, a smaller property to a bigger property when you can afford to do so, when you maybe afford to stretch yourself a little bit. So that's what I've always done in the London property market. And in the stock market, actually, if I look at my portfolio, you know, my best stocks actually generally have been, you know, the longer term holdings, some of those investment trusts that I've held for, you know, a number of years, you know, are the ones that are looking at the best gains.
Yeah, I've talked to Annabelle Brody-Smith and Nick Britton, who runs this training for AIC, and we conversed about the Dividend Heroes The City of London has been increasing its dividends for nearly 50 years. 50 years, in fact.
Yeah. The fund manager of the City of London was one of the guys that I used to ring up every day when I was on the sales desk.
Fantastic.
But yeah.
Oh, there you go. And did you take any hints and tips from him?
Well, actually, funnily enough, he and another colleague of his, both of whom I happened to know socially, because we'd all been at school together, as luck has it. And the other manager run, they're still together. Those two guys are still together at Henderson's now, having, they've worked together for 25 years or so. And funny enough, their investing style, I think, did inform me quite well, which was very much the value end of things, i.e. that stocks have low P's and high yields, but also have strong balance sheets and good cash flow, quite often can be very undervalued. And at the same time, if they're in unloved sectors, unglamorous sectors, unloved sectors, sectors that are out of fashion, quite often it really pays to be contrarian and to buy into things when they're flat in the back and go against the herd, basically. And good way of doing that quite often, that's one of the great things about the mid cap and small cap is they're actually under researched, they're underbroked, and actually that's the one chance a private investor has to get ahead of the professional investors, because we're not in a perfect market where the thing is, Glaxo or British Telecom is going to be followed by 20 or 30 analysts, and the likelihood is that the share price is going to be pretty close to fair value. Whereas in a mid cap or a small cap only followed by two brokers is quite likely to be mispriced, giving us all an opportunity to make some money, hopefully.
No, that's a great thing. I mean, they've done ever so well, City of London, and the great thing about it is that he remains humble. And I think one of his quotes was the fact that we're not looking for to hit it's anything out of the park. We're looking for the little small runs.
He
was quoted as saying a little while ago. I think that's just brilliant. 50 years consistent dividend growth.
Fantastic.
Great for the shareholders.
Yeah.
Right. Reg, given all the many lessons that you've learned since you started trading, investing, which one would you most like to share with our listeners that we've not covered thus far?
Gosh. I suppose the one around the risk side of things, and following you and I, as we do, following things on Twitter, one of the things that slightly scared me on a few occasions is seeing tweets from people who've got very small concentrated portfolios, i.e. small number of stocks, concentrated portfolios. That really scares me, because it means that you're so hugely exposed, if one stock goes wrong, and we've, as we've discussed earlier, there's one stock we're familiar with, discussed today, which has had a profit warning this week. And it's very easy for people to lose a lot of money, if they only hold 10 stocks. So I would absolutely encourage investors to have a broad and diverse portfolio in order to limit that risk. Now, by the same token, it's going to limit the upside. If you pick good stocks, then you'll still benefit from the good times, and hopefully won't be overly affected by the bad times. So I think that risk thing is really important. And if you do look at if you look at what the professional fund managers do, that one of the things they're best at managing is risk.
And they do have quite a large portfolio within those funds as well.
Absolutely.
They really have 250 stocks? Why don't they buy an ETF?
Quite. I think 250 is a bit over the top. I think probably the better ones might have 80 to 120.
They do.
Yeah.
But when you consider the fact that they've got, the level of asset under management that they've got to spread the risk, haven't they?
Absolutely. Interesting. I mean, there are a couple of investment trusts which are very focused. And obvious one is Terry Smith's funds, the Fund Smith funds, and another one called Linsell Train, which is one of Nick Train's funds that he manages. And then there's something that there's a couple of ones that I have, Strategic Equity Capital and Crystal Amber, Which are very focused and only have, you know, 10, 15, 20 holdings. But the difference and why I feel comfortable owning their shares and then having such a concentrated portfolio is that they've got very rigorous criteria about what they buy, and therefore they don't expose themselves to the risk that might come from having a concentrated portfolio with slightly riskier stocks in it.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the thing with the Terry Smith one as well is that very little churning. He's like, I bought this and
I'm sticking with it.
Chances are very low because I'm not going to be selling it. I'm just going to stay in here and buying more as more assets comes under management.
That's right.
And he's had a very good record with that.
He has indeed. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so is the Lindell Train one as well. That's done very, very well.
It has.
I'm not really aware of the strategic capital one, but I'll have to look at that one.
Yes, so SEC is the ticker.
That's synonymous with other things, obviously. SEC.
I almost wonder whether whether that ticker was chosen on purpose.
Okie dokie. Right. This is one of my favourite questions. If there was one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, Reg, what would it be?
Well, without sort of repeating what others have said, I think there was a wise thing said by Leon in his interview, which is the point around private investors having greater access to share placings, to IPOs, etc., etc. And I think it is, you know, it bugs the hell out of me that, you know, when I'd like to buy a particular stock or I've got a stock and I'd like to buy more, you know, I suddenly find there's been an institutional placing, you know, and I can't get the stock. You know, I'm not involved. Now, there are lots of practical reasons why that is the case, because companies need to raise money quickly and efficiently. And so I absolutely understand the reasons why it happens. But it is, you know, it is a pity that, that is difficult for us to get involved. And it's ironic that quite often when there is a retail offer for, say, an IPO, you know, quite often the quality of the IPOs is not always that great. When I think about the fact that I went for a few HSS, thinking it's a good, you know, thinking to myself it's a really good brand, not unattractive for that reason, and in a good sort of, you know, a solid sector, and of course it turned out to be a complete disaster area. So it's a bit of a dilemma in a sense. You know, we'd like greater access to those placings, but it's difficult for us to do so. I think the remuneration thing is probably worth, if I could have more than one thing to raise, I think it'd be nice if somehow private investors as a group could have more say on remuneration. And I admire what ShareSoc are trying to do on that front, because it's clear that, you know, some companies have been, a little bit sailing close to the wind on that front. So I think that also, and I think the other thing that I'd like to see more of, or a change, is greater access for private investors to analyst research. And the FCA has this slightly ridiculous view that private investors shouldn't be allowed to see the research from the investment banks because they're not expert investors. And that it's an inducement and so on and so forth. And I think that's actually completely wrong. You know, that's the kind of nanny regulator gone too far. And, you know, I think that there should be more open availability, you know, of research. So, you know, wonderful as Edison and Equity Development and Hardman are, you know, it would be great if private investors could see some of the other research, which is often why I tweet little tidbits, you know, from some of the broker notes that I get to see through work.
That's excellent that you do that, Reg. I was going to touch on the fact that when it suits the FCA and the government, i.e. back into the, even as early as the 80s, when there was privatisations and nationalisation of companies, we got broker notes within the IPO, didn't we? Regarding how well
British
Gas were doing or how British Telecom were doing. It suited them then.
Yeah.
20 years, 30 years on now, they're still saying, "No, we can't show you those broker notes because you're not sophisticated enough."
yeah, exactly. I mean, it may be, you know, one of the golden linings of Brexit may be that the UK can perhaps decide that it's going to regulate itself, on a more individual basis and not slavishly follow what the EU's been doing. So there is a chance, I think, for the FCA to say, well, actually, some of these things which are partly been imposed by the FCA, by the EU, actually we're going to row back from that and do things the way we think is best to do them. So, I mean, that's a potential hope that we might have.
That's a very, very good point. My only caveat being with that, Veg, is that with regards to what's, I mean, it's slightly different in the sense it's connected, is that LSE, as in the stock exchange, is going to be taken over at some point, looking like, you know, German Deutsche Börse. And that's going to put a whole different spin on how things are done, I think, in the city, or where the LSE, London Stock Exchange, is going to be. So I've got my concerns about that particular merger. I hope somebody comes in at the last minute and says, no, it's not going ahead. Everyone seems to be voting it through pretty rapidly to get their the exchange rate on the purchase, which is now 10 to 12 to 15% cheaper than it was 2 weeks ago.
No, indeed.
Okay, I've got my very last question.
Right.
Ask you about your choice of books, which I always like to find out about people's books that they like to read and what they recommend. What is the best kept secret to investing, Reg, in your personal opinion?
Ooh, best kept secret. I think one of the best kept secrets is what I call the kind of personal experience one. So I think if you shop at a particular shop or you use a particular service and you're a fan of it, then actually that's a really good reason to go and buy the shares. And I think probably we don't do enough of that because, you know, in our lives all around us, you know, we are using products and services, you know, sold by companies, you know, whose shares we can buy. And actually a lot of people in my experience have made really good money because they've known about those opportunities because of the fact that they've used the product or the service and they thought, I wonder who makes that, or I could buy some shares in it. So I think that's maybe a little sort of a little nugget which is quite interesting. And equally, by the same token, I met a guy in the last couple of years socially who was one of the founders of one of the North Sea oil exploration companies that's quoted on the exchange and has been listed now for sort of 5 or 10 years. And I had invested in a couple of relatively speculative explorers sort of a year or two before that. And when I met him, I said, oh, what do you think of stock A and stock B? And he said, oh, crikey, I wouldn't touch those two with a barge pole. You know, their assets are really, you know, they may be huge, but they're going to be really difficult assets to commercialize, you know, because of where they are, because of the difficulty of extracting it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And what I should have done is listen to him, because he really knew what he was talking about. And I should have sold the shares the following morning. And of course I didn't, because I thought, well, what I sort of didn't think, what does he know? But I just thought, yeah, that's quite interesting. But,
I'd done far more research on the stock.
And those broker notes I saw say, you know, they're still telling me there's a compelling case. So I think now and again, you know, where you've got an opportunity to ask somebody who knows more about a sector than you do, you know, quite often you might get some really interesting insights. But you need to do your due diligence on that person, in a sense. Yeah. You know, they've got to be somebody you trust and who you know actually has got that, you know, insider's knowledge, i.e. industry insider's knowledge, which can help inform, you know, decisions that you might take.
Brilliant answer. I love that reply. Thank you for that, Reg. I wanted to touch on now your books and books that you recommend, books that you've read over again, and are your favourite books regarding investing.
Gosh, actually, I'm going to make a confession, which is probably one of my areas of weakness is I haven't really read any investment books over the years.
You'd think you'd read a few more books, or you've read enough books being an academic, you thought, oh, I'm not reading anymore.
Yeah, no, I haven't, and that's probably a weakness and something I should spend a bit more time doing when I've got that time. When I have that time. So that's a note to self.
Okay. Not to worry. I mean, I won't be so rude as to recommend any to you because you're an expert in your field, but there's a few out there anyway. You've got a large library to fill, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I suppose I've spent more time, just as a sort of as an aside to that, I've probably spent more time in the last few years reading stuff online, where people have written interesting articles, interesting articles about Warren Buffett's investing style or whatever. So slightly lazily, I guess, just reading an article which has sort of, given me a précis of a several hundred page book, which I've been able to read in 5 minutes. So I guess I've certainly been inquisitive in terms of taking the opportunity to learn from those sages.
Excellent. Now, Reg, what I'd like you to do, if you can, is that when your events, when your MHP are doing their next events, or you've got a diary of events for the next couple of months, if you could forward them to LSE Share Talk, so we can
definitely
promote them.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And going forward, at some point, LSE Share Talk, we'll be doing our own events. And it'd be great to probably contact yourself as well to see if you're available and if you're in London to come and give a talk on your specialist subject.
Yeah, delighted to do that.
So that'd be great to do that. I wanted to ask you if there's anything that we've missed in the conversations we've had that you'd like to share with our global audience on Conquest Corner. Is there anything you think we've missed or skipped that you think is
good? Yeah, I tell you what, I suppose it's actually something that again, other interviewees have talked about, but I think is a really interesting sort of area, which is this whole thing around blue sky stocks.
Yes.
And, the last few years has really, really, should we say, uncovered a few real dogs in that respect, and I think all of us, if we're honest, have had a few of them, all of us hopefully have avoided a few others, yeah, absolutely, and there've been one or two I've made money out of, and thank God I've got out of, and because I'm a man that likes to take a profit when there's one to be had, but equally there've been one or two that I've been stuck in. And I think it's just one of those ones where, ultimately one's got to make sure that one hasn't got too many. Inevitably, one will be attracted to one or two of them. And the key is not to get carried away and end up with a portfolio which has got, all blue sky stocks and no proper stocks. But it's interesting to note there's one particular one, and we haven't mentioned many company names, but particularly interested to note that, for example, Nanoco, which is a classic blue sky stock and whose share price has been an absolute roller coaster, actually has, since Brexit, I think it's gone up 40%, albeit from a low base. So, and I think there's a perception there that that's one that's, close to an inflection point. So it's interesting how quite often these things will eventually have their day. But so often it's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years after it was meant to have been. And the trick is obviously to hope that it survives long enough for that, for the potential to be realized. But in the meantime, I think be very wary and very, very careful.
Very cautious, that's a very, very good point there. I mean, Nanoco was one I had a couple of years back, I think. And I love my tech, as you know.
Yeah.
And I did my research on it, and they had everything in place. Mm. And I was thinking, okay, now we've got Dow Chemical jumping on board. They're either going to tease out the technology and see that it works and either consume them, or they're going to back it and it's going to push them on. So I had earmarked it for 2014, 2015 for them to kick on. The EU was going to say, yes, we can only have this type of LED.
Yeah.
And Nanoco was going to be the next thing since sliced bread. And then 2014, 2015, it didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
Time to get out.
Yeah.
And I've not even been watching it recently since. I've missed that 40% rise, Reg, because I was like, it hasn't happened. It's not going to happen. Therefore, move on. And sometimes that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Well, actually, equally, what I do in some of these things is if they go up initially on the excitement, I think, take some profits, but de-risk it, bank the profit, but maybe keep a few just to see what happens. And then you've got the option, either way, to either add a few more, if inevitably they go down in the meantime, but if you're still convinced by the story, or equally, you can sell out the balance, if they keep going the wrong way, but at least you've taken some profit, and you know, your overall net risk, as it were, in terms of that position has been sort of mitigated to some extent. So again, you know, one of my mantras is actually one I borrowed from being a bridge player, a very amateurish bridge player, but one that I enjoy now and again, which is, they say, there's an expression, they say that many a man is walking the Chelsea embankment who didn't play out his trumps. And by the same token, you can say there's many a man walking the Chelsea embankment, you know, who didn't take a profit, you know, when he had one on a blue sky stock. So I'm always keen to take profits off the table, leave some of the upside, you know, to the next man. And I think that's a strong lesson in those kind of concept stocks.
I completely agree. I mean, I tend to try and push for my 100% return on blue sky stocks before I cut and have what I call a free carry.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely de-risk.
Yeah.
But on the larger stocks, I tend to just, really, really good ones, I just tend to just leave them, and people say, "Oh, Pete, you're so patient with that. You've never endured all kinds of things with that." And the classic is AstraZeneca, which is in portfolio since '94, and just this week, I had Melrose come back and purchase that Novtech company in the US.
Yeah,
and I think it went up 50% on the day. I was like, "That's just crazy."
Yeah,
you know, it's a FTSE 250 company going on to be a FTSE 100 company. How does that go up 50% in a day? So I didn't have any choice but to take some off the table.
Yeah.
Again. And I was thinking, right, okay, great. And they've turned every pound invested in Melrose, made it £9 for the investors since they started. So they've got a fantastic management team. But I just thought the market's just getting carried away. So I just had no choice, really.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Reg, we've covered all the questions, mate.
Excellent.
Really appreciate you giving up your time and
sharing
this information with
Pleasure.
Share Talk and with me on Conker's Corner. I look forward to working with you in the future. I just wanted to just ask you once again, if there's anything you wanted to touch on that we've not covered. Otherwise, we've covered everything here now.
I think we've covered most things, and if I've forgotten anything that I should have mentioned, then I'm sure it will wait for another day. And it's probably what I should say for any listeners that sort of see my name on the bottom of company RNSs, just to be absolutely clear, we are not allowed at MHP to invest in our clients' shares. So that's the first point. So I will never invest in my client shares. And secondly, I will never tweet about my client shares for that same reason, in order to kind of retain that sort of credibility. So that's an important point probably to make for those that don't know me.
Yeah, it's all about being ethical, isn't it?
And absolutely.
And having complete clarity.
Yeah.
Okay then, chap. That's the end of the recording. I look forward to speaking with you soon and obviously sharing tweets and information. If there's anything you want to share with LSE Share Talk, please just contact me or the team. And I look forward to speaking to you soon again, then, Reg.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Peter.
Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Nice.
Bye.
Now.